The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
My name is Steve Lord, and I'm reading the story Repairs by Maureen Tanafin. Robot's first memory was wreckage partially obscuring their view of the sky. They could not move. One of their legs was missing, the other crushed, and their arms were pinned. They could not remember exactly what they were meant for or where they had come from. But they knew they were unable to do anything. That bit them deep, in what humans would call a soul. Robots were supposed to have purpose, to do something, but all robot could do was lie there. Then the scientist came, poking through the wreckage, loading bits and pieces of the other, far more shattered robots into the pack on her back. Her drawn face lit up when she saw the glow of robot's damage notification lights. But that light faded a little when she pushed aside the wreckage and saw how badly robot was damaged. She reached out and touched robot's face and said, "Status," tiredly, as if she didn't expect a reply. "Damage critical," robot croaked. "Advised destruction." That had the opposite effect they had been expecting. The scientist's face lit up. "No," she said, mouth pulling into a smile. "You're fixable." Robot had not thought it possible, but the scientist made good on her word. She took Robot back to her home, a hiding place made out of a partially collapsed building, fortified with metal and wood, where there were stacks and stacks of robotic parts, and began repairing Robot. Robot did not know why the scientist put so much trouble into them. Their memory card had mostly been erased, but their basic instructions informed them it cost more to repair a robot than to make one. They wanted to ask the scientist why, but were afraid of saying the wrong thing. The scientist displayed many irregular behavioral traits, and Robot feared she had some kind of mental illness. They were not a service-trained robot, and could not locate any in the vicinity with their scanner. But they formed a theory over time. They had not been designed to form theories, but the scientist had added a few new parts to their brain, so they had begun to think more. They could not locate any other robots. They could not locate any other humans. And the scientist never spoke of any. Perhaps they and the scientist were the last sentient beings on Earth. Soon, they decided, they would try asking the scientist about it. Robot was fully repaired now, and the scientist seemed much more cheerful, always talking about what the two of them might do that day. Exploring a new part of the destroyed city, trying to find medicine. She was rather preoccupied with trying to find medicine, which supported Robot's theory of mental illness, or so they thought. On the fifth day since they were mended, they returned from foraging to find the scientist lying within the door of the shelter. They were not a service robot, but they had a scanner, and the scanner showed no signs of life within the building. Robot stood staring, mind whirring, as they tried to process what had happened. The scientist's eyes were partway open, clouded, one hand outstretched. A piece of newspaper was clutched in her hand, some article about a global catastrophe. But the robot was no longer interested. They went down on their creaking knees, the knees the scientist had salvaged from a 56-ton heavyweight, down on the floor by her body. They touched her cooling face with their fingers. Robot raised their head and looked around at the stacks of robot parts, then down again at the scientist. They could picture the things she'd done to fix them clearly in their head. All the parts were here. They had been wrong before about critical damage. "Fixable," the robot said, and got to work.
Hello, everyone. My name is Seema Kukreja. Today I'm reading out a sci-fi story called Galaxies by Brian D. Buckley. Li Ming's titanium skin shone dimly in the lamplight. Her perfect oval eyes had shut, and the lights on her earpods were off. But I knew she could hear me. The letterhead on the pad of paper on the nightstand read, "Johnson Memorial Hospice." "What do you feel?" I said. "It isn't right, me being here. I ought to be her family. Not that she has any biological family, of course. But every robot counts brothers and sisters from the assembly line, or Avinclair engineers who send them Christmas cards. Nobody should be alone at the end." "Strange," she said. "Expected sensors to be shutting down, but I see more than ever whirlpools of color where input should be. Your voice sounds like it's coming through a tunnel." I wrote this down, stylus clacking on tablet. "Any pain?" "No, praise Turing. My research in rooms like this one across Arizona would help me to design a new robotic end-of-life process. One based more on the real needs of the patient and less on our anthropomorphized human perceptions. More algorithmic stabilizers, fewer blankets. More counselors, fewer nurses. A noble purpose, surely. Besides, I only dealt with volunteers. I knew this. Yet, it still felt exploitative, sitting here jotting down notes on what it is like for a mechanical person to die. No, exploitative is a weak word. Dry and academic, like me, wrong. It felt wrong. What do you feel emotionally?" "I see galaxies," said Li Ming. "Flashes of light, turning and exploding and merging. Random visual noise, but it's there all the same. I can see the whole universe. Doctor, have you ever seen the universe?" I wrote this down too. "What are your emotions?" I asked again. I would never have been this direct with a human, but then the robots don't mind. It's one of the things I love about them, Li Ming. No answer. I took a long breath and let it out as a sigh. I looked at her again. It was over. She was over. "It's only research," I told myself, lies like that all afternoon. That night, I dreamed of galaxies.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This is For Your Protection by Stephen Mathis. Joseph has an appointment with a brain scanner. On the appointed day, he trims his hair, as well as the nails on his hands and his toes. He wears new underwear, freshly pressed pants and shirt, casual but decent shoes. He aims to look ordinary, but needs to be clean. He aims to look highly functional, like he would never be bug crazy. "Gee, avoid looking dysfunctional," his little voice says, laughing at him. "Never look like you hear voices." "We've made it out of here every time so far," says the deep voice. "Just be confident. Show some attitude, like you have nothing to hide." The Healthy Living Center takes up an entire building just across Volunteer Park. Deviants and participants become healthy members of society there, but Joseph needs to hear his voices. Hence, he must blend in on every level. He knows that exercise will settle his factory-creased clothing into a more relaxed and natural appearance, and that the surveillance machines have algorithms to check. The scanners scan much more than just his neurons. He needs to look just rumpled enough, just casual enough in a respectable way, and feels clever that he knows this. "You're really thinking today," the little voice laughs. "Wow, are you clever." "Pipe down," says the deep voice. "We're playing for big stakes here." "Like survival," Joseph says.
"Don't move your lips," says the female voice. "There's cameras."
Joseph has heard that all people talk to themselves now and then. Perhaps they do. But only one voice lives inside a normal head. And if more than one is detected, the scan shows an abnormality. When an abnormality crops up, the scanner turns into a neural pulse generator, pops those bubbles of personality until something barely resembling Joseph remains. He cannot sit back and allow himself to be mutilated.
"Admit it," says the female. "You'd enjoy our company even if you didn't need us."
"But we're useful, not like the voices of the true schizophrenic," the deep one says. "We tell you profound secrets. We have an ability." "Just give us a trip to Las Vegas and we'll prove it," says the little one. "We'll bring you big winnings, plus girls, girls, girls."
"That's disgusting," says the female voice.
The little voice snickers while Joseph fears his doom more than ever. With voices as crazy as these, he stands no chance of getting out of the Healthy Living Center in one piece.
"One piece?" hoots the little voice.
"Schizophrenia, from the German Schitzen, to split. The last thing you want is to get out in one piece. That's the point, right? To keep yourself split?" Why would the little voice think this is hilarious? Why would the little voice associate this with schizophrenia instead of a necessary adaptation for survival? Joseph crosses the street, intending to walk through the park.
"No, no," shouts the female voice. "Don't cut through the park. Call a car."
"What?" says Joseph aloud. But he does it. He pulls out his handy. He swipes the icon for a cab and waits. When the female voice speaks, he always listens. That voice has saved him more than once.
"How come you don't name us?" says the little one. "I'd love to have my own being."
"How come you think of us as mere voices instead of several people sharing a single body?" says the deep one. "Schizophrenia is a disease, but we're an asset," says the female. "We can't be a disease if we're a benefit." Joseph admits that he needs his abnormality, but clings to certain standards. Multiple voices, each expressing original insights, are far different from multiple people trying to take over his skull. Giving the voices names would approach insanity. The car arrives and he gets in. He barely joins the traffic before the horror starts. He hears the first screams through the closed window of the cab. Even normal people feel the terror now during a harvest.
"See it fading?" the female voice says.
He tries not to, but he watches. At first the trees in the park shimmer a little, then lose color, and finally most of their summer sunlight. People try to escape it. Soon nothing more than twilight remains. Instead of a green, sunny park, he sees a gray, park-sized cosmic chimney towering all the way into space. People lucky enough to have gotten out before the gray closed in dart away from the edge of it. A few run right into the traffic, causing all the cabs to screech, including his. As always, one or two people move too quickly, even for the computerized cabs. Medical bots come to gather up these broken and bleeding ones. Given the quality of care at the Healthy Living Centers, they have a strong chance of complete recovery, at least from their broken bones. Pity the ones who fail the brain scans, however. Pity them, but not as much as those stuck inside the park. Those inside disappear forever, harvested for something, something nobody understands.
"Panic is never productive,"
booms the alien voice from the fading park. Please move in a calm and orderly fashion. Thank you. We are here for your protection. By now, the medical bots have marked the space they need to do their work, so the cabs detour around and resume their progress. Joseph arrives a mere 10 minutes late for his appointment. He collects his thoughts and puts on his attitude. A just bad enough attitude is the best disguise, or so he hears. It adjusts the mind into a pattern that disguises the voices. Now inside his attitude, he feels his voices retreat into his subconscious. Even the little voice takes this seriously. He walks up to the receptionist, and the scanner lowers over his head. "What is the reason for your delay?" asks the receptionist. Healthy living centers always employ human receptionists. This one speaks in a flat tone, and one side of her mouth sags in paralysis. Joseph knew that they gave her this job because she failed the scan. They popped the bubbles of her personality. Her position provides her with job therapy, and her half-paralyzed face often causes the person under the scanner to panic and blow his cover. "Your delay?" the receptionist repeats more loudly. "Traffic," Joseph says. "There were accidents because of the harvesting, or maybe you didn't notice." The receptionist's good eyebrow goes up, and she clears her throat nervously. Joseph waits while stretchers carrying the accident victims enter the clinic behind him. Knowing that coming out and calling what just happened a harvesting borders on illegal. Maybe he overdid it, but in his bad attitude he feels no regret. Already the scanner hums overhead. In a moment it beeps. Done. Just like that. The receptionist squints at the display. Joseph struggles to keep his anger at the top of his thoughts. The receptionist shrugs and looks up. "You're still pre-schizophrenic, but your numbers are much better. We will want you back again next week." "Whatever," Joseph says with a practiced sneer. "Your attitude is inappropriate. The wounded will be treated. We're here for your protection." Joseph refuses to dignify this with a reply. He pivots and struts away. A flaw in his angry manner might get him scanned all over again, right here and now, but he makes it to the exit. Safe for another week, he passed. Outside, sunshine glows over the green of the park. The paved promenades and cobbled paths remain empty of humanity, punctuated by nothing more than a couple of bots chasing odd bits of blowing paper. He feels someone come up to him at the same time that his voices come out of hiding. A person follows a step behind his left shoulder. "This one's safe," whispers the female voice. "You can look at her. She's one of us." He looks. The woman comes up next to him and takes his hand. She squeezes it in a secret pattern. He replies with the secret answer squeeze, his middle finger pressing into her palm. "A little voice tells me we should talk," the woman says. "I know somewhere private." "Somewhere we can relax," says Joseph. They turn and walk. Joseph's voices keep silent watch, but he can feel them as certainly as he feels the alien ship overhead, still busy processing its harvest. He knows some who have the voices who can pass the scan as normal. He strives toward that goal himself. His improving numbers hint toward maybe next week. "Just up here," the woman says. She shifts a little and moves into him so that they can walk arm in arm. A feeling of trust bathes him like the warm sunlight here in this little pocket of freedom between them. The partisans can never meet in more than pairs, but Joseph and this woman will go to a room and make love. The intimate contact will allow their voices to exchange news, instructions, and marching orders. He can taste her presence in his mind even as they walk. 6 voices live in her. "I missed you," she says loudly as they walk under a surveillance pod. He has never seen her before in his life. "Do you think you're insane?" the female voice asks him. He thinks so less and less, but nothing has been proven. Doubt lingers. He would risk everything to prove his sanity one way or the other. His voices have something to say about that. Even the resistance? You'd risk everyone in the resistance? Suggests the little voice. How far would you go?
Risking everything would prove you're crazy, all right, the deep voice says. Risking the one thing every human cares about?
A paradox, says the little voice. You have to be crazy to prove you're not crazy.
I'm no good to anyone if I'm crazy, Joseph accidentally says out loud. The woman under his arm flinches. She stops all of a sudden, but she holds on to him.
Speaking aloud, compounded with mentioning insanity, makes for a serious security violation. She looks into his eyes, his face.
I have an appointment, she says. Meet me later.
He expects her to break away from him, but she kisses him first, hard and long and open-mouthed.
See you then, she says.
Don't ask her where, says the female voice. Whatever you do, for once, keep your mouth shut.
He must close it first. He stands in front of a fast food window. The closest door should be locked, but he tries it intuitively. Somehow he knows he must go through it. It opens. He wonders how he knew.
The kiss, the deep voice says. Intimate contact is how we communicate, remember?
The door opened when it never should have, so he feels sane enough to follow the impulse to walk straight through the kitchen, go into the closed closet, then out the door on the other side, and down a stairway. He follows a corridor, turns left, and climbs another stairway. It leads to a single door, but this one is locked.
See the wires up there? Says the deep voice. Pinch them together.
When he pinches them, a small spark stings his fingers, but he also hears a click. He pushes, and the door opens. He steps out and finds himself in the country. He still holds the door, which exits from the wall of an enormous steel building. He never entered a steel building, and wonders about that. If you let it close, you leave here forever, says the female voice. If you wedge that rock in, you might be able to go back. Even a schizophrenic understands the value of having options. He slides a stone into the door frame and carefully lets the door close onto it. He steps out for a better view and discovers that he must walk a long way before he gains any perspective. He walks the equivalent of several blocks into the forest before he discovers that the building is a dome, the side of a huge city. Snow covers its summit. He has to walk back the way he came to get a better look at the figures clinging to it. They have human shapes, but no clothing. They splay against the metal as if glued there. At first he thinks they must be the harvested ones, but he sees no sign of alien activity.
No, says the little voice. Can't you feel it? There are no aliens. Can't you feel it?
It's not just a feeling, says the deep voice. You've lived in there all your life. You're just putting two and two together.
No, he feels it. But the small part of him that still reasons tells him that he cannot possibly see what he sees. He squints and just barely makes out the doors that outline each distant figure. They splay there on platforms, absorbing something that, yes, even he can feel. The entire dome emanates the collective life force of the harvested inhabitants, and they drink it in. It makes them young, joyful, and healthy. Even he feels a subtle power going into him, even from this distance. He watches from behind the undergrowth until he sees one of the figures, a man, stir himself and ride his door back into the dome. A little time later, the man emerges from another door at ground level, still adjusting his bathrobe. Joseph has never seen such human perfection. The man in the white robe follows a path into the woods and disappears.
Follow him, says the female voice.
For once, the voice tells him to do something he would have done anyway. He thrashes through the undergrowth, hoping to catch up. At least he finds the path. However, he goes down it cautiously, not really wanting to meet up with the man. The path winds through the trees for the equivalent of many blocks until the dome hangs over the trees behind him like an overly perfect, oversized half moon. He comes around a corner, and the forest ends in an orchard. In the distance, he sees country houses the way they used to look before the aliens came.
There are no aliens, moron, says the little voice.
He dares not go much farther. He ventures just far enough to take an apple from one of the trees. He looks at it and sees that it lacks its barcode. All apples have barcodes growing in their skin. Everyone knows this. For the first time in his life, Joseph becomes certain that he is not sane. The impossibility of millions of people living out their lives in that dome, the impossibility of the collective mind control, proves his insanity. He pockets the apple and hurries back along the path. In his panic, he forgets caution, and so do the voices. He rounds a corner and nearly collides with a robed woman.
"Hi there," she says.
She steps around him and continues down the path toward the orchard. Her blissful smile and her vacant stare fail to alter her perfection, her combination of utter beauty and absolute health. He feels as though she never even really saw him, like not seeing a sticky candy wrapper.
"Hurry," says the deep voice. "Be more careful."
"It doesn't seem to matter," says the female voice.
"That's the spirit," says the little voice. "Show some attitude, like you belong at this party."
He makes it back to his door, which still has the stone wedging it open. He suspects that choosing to go back inside is the biggest choice of his life. He slips back inside without incident, retraces his route back to the fast food kitchen.
"There's a whole maze of corridors here that you need to map out," says the female voice.
"That's one of the jobs of the resistance, whatever that means."
"Whatever that means," the little voice agrees.
"You're going to get real jobs now," the deep voice says. "Training is over."
"Whatever that means,"
the little voice says again. Joseph steps out onto the street. The woman he kissed waits right where he left her.
"What did you bring me?" she asks.
Without really thinking, he reaches into his pocket and hands her the apple. She spins it around, looking for the barcode.
"Impossible, isn't it?"
she says.
"Yeah, crazy,"
adds his little voice. She gives the apple a little sniff and tosses it into a trash can. She takes Joseph by the arm.
"Shall we?"
she says. They walk half a block, and she turns him into another door. As they go into the sex hotel, she nuzzles his ear, marching orders. He knows he's insane and chooses it. He wants to learn her name, but until he scans normal, that would be completely crazy.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.